I'd like to thank today's sponsors of the Wellness Way podcast, London Nootropics. London Nootropics adaptogenic coffee blends are designed to help you stay balanced and elevate your day. They give you all the benefits of regular coffee, but they minimise the side effects such as the jitters, anxiety and that well-known crash. Lovingly made with the highest quality medicinal mushroom extracts and other adaptogens. Each blend is designed for a specific purpose. Flow for mental clarity and focus, Zen to alleviate stress and anxiety, and Mojo for that natural boost. You can read more about their blends and the adaptogens they contain on their website, londonnootropics.com. And if you'd like to learn more about their blends and their astonishing journey, why don't you go and check out our podcast episode together, where you can learn more about the boys from London Nootropics. And don't forget to use my exclusive discount, Philly20, for your 20% off. Cheers, London Nootropics. Enjoy the rest of the show. Welcome to The Wellness Way with me, Philly J. Lay, a layperson's guide to your natural health systems, your very own NHS. Hello, lovely people, and welcome to another episode of The Wellness Way. And today I'm going to introduce you to a friend of mine, Rafe Nowen. Oh, for some reason, I've been saying Rafe's name wrong for the last 5 years, and he just pulled me on it. So we've had to do a number of different interviews here for me to get his name right. And I do apologise, Rafe. We were lucky enough to work together, when was it, 5 years ago, training as EFT Matrix Reimprint Practitioners. Rafe is an author. He is a hypnotherapist. But most importantly to me, and something I want to talk to him about today, is family constellations. Now, I remember giving my sister a plaque to put on her door. I think it was for her, 18th birthday. It might have been that cruel, actually. And it said, very simply, God gave us our families. Thank God we can choose our friends. Oh, what a bitch of a sister I am. But we all take on this family trauma with us, and we take on the constellations of the energies. And I've never really understood why people think that we carry forward a family line of DNA, but we don't take their emotions with you. So without any further ado, I am going to introduce you to Rafe. Hi, Rafe. It's so lovely to have you on the show.
Oh, lovely to be here. Thank you. Yeah, bless you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into this, because it's not something you go to the school careers officer and say, oh, I'm going to do family constellations for a living. So I know there's a story behind it. So share it with us, please.
Yeah. I mean, it depends a bit where you are. If you were living in Germany or Switzerland or some of the German speaking countries, you might well say, I want to be a family constellation facilitator, because it's much more common there. If you go to a psychotherapist in those countries, they will definitely have in their toolbox some family constellation work. Now, they'll either be doing it themselves within their framework of work, or they'll know a practitioner somewhere else. I mean, I've had a sort of checkerboard career of doing lots of different things. I started off as a farmer and, you know, I've gone through lots of different processes. And in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, I was an IT consultant.
The Wellness Way presents Barbara O'Neill. Barbara is coming to talk in London, June the 11th, 2024. Go to phillyjlay.com to secure your tickets now. We'll see you there.
But my second wife, Maya, she was dying of cancer. And as a child, I'd always been brought up to believe that everything was my fault. I just got blamed for everything. If somebody knocked a vase over, it was probably me that did it. And if I said I wasn't even in the room, I was probably lying. So I got too used to the idea that when things happened, it was my fault. So when my second wife was dying, I felt, do you know what? I'm not prepared to take this on. This isn't something I want to feel responsible for. So I finally got round to going and getting help. And I went to see a psychotherapist in Derby. And the second session that we had, he said, listen, Rafe, this is, you know, psychotherapy deals with the individual. You're looking at their behaviours, their trappings, the things that they've got inside them. And, you know, sometimes you might say, well, that belongs over there. But there's nothing much you can do about it. But what he said to me was that this you need to go and see a constellation therapist. And I had no idea what that meant. No idea at all. I didn't even know why it was called constellations at that time. It's called constellations because if you take, for example, the plough, and you were standing on one of the stars on the plough, everything would look completely different to the way it looks from here. And the distance between one star and another in the plough, when I look out of the window, it's about, you know, 10 centimetres. In the real world, it's 4,000 light years or something, or 10,000. I'm not even sure. But the point is that you see things from different angles. And he sent me down to a workshop in London, where I was introduced to this concept where you're mapping the hidden dynamics within family systems. And I absolutely could see that the stuff that I was carrying. It wasn't me. It wasn't in me. It wasn't in my DNA or anything. I was carrying it. It's an observable extra that I didn't want.
I think a lot of us carry things that we don't want. And I know that when we worked and trained together, we had an experience. You had an experience. Do you mind sharing that with us, or would you rather not?
No, not at all. No. I'm not quite sure which experience you're referring to, but
I was working with you when I took you back to a near-death medical experience when you were very little and with scalding water. And
I mean, what happened was that I was about 18 months old. I was one of those kids that was always free thinking and, you know, doing what I wanted to do. You know, I learned to walk when I was 9 months, and, you know, it wasn't because my parents were pushing me, it was because they weren't. And I reached up for my glass of orange juice and picked my mother's boiling milk for her cocoa and poured it over me. So I got a really bad burn on my chest. And in the session that I did with Philly at that time, what showed up was that actually for a few moments I'd had a reboot. I recognized that my heart stopped and my breathing stopped for seconds, probably not minutes, but seconds. But what it showed me was that there was a moment to adjust everything. That it was like, do I want to be alive? Do I want to be dead? Do I want, you know, it sort of gave me the ultimate choices of everything in life. And it really has inspired the journey that I've had. So I'm, you know, very happy about learning that. But I recognized that my mother was sort of, I mean, the stereotypical sort of Hoover advert of the 1950s, that was my mum, you know, and I could kind of visualize her in that piece of work going through the playbook. You know, where the hell do I sort out, you know, my 18-month-old boy who's died? And there was no A&E then. You didn't call an ambulance. You know, it was that panic led them to just kind of dismiss me. And I recognized also that my father had probably, he'd seen a lot of death in the war, so he was kind of not fazed by it. And it was kind of just a bit weird, but it alerted me to, you know, who I am.
Sorry to interrupt this podcast. The Wellness Way has got a brand new interactive ebook out. I've created a beginner's guide to your natural health systems to help you navigate through the jungle of natural health. A banquet of knowledge wrapped up in a simple ebook. Featuring some of my top guests from the podcast. As an added bonus, I've even thrown in my meditation album, The Wellness Awakening, From Past Lives to Passing. Head over to my webpage, phillyjlay.com, to grab your copy now. And while you're there, why don't you sign up for my newsletter? And don't forget to like, subscribe and share this podcast so we can continue to get this information out. Remember, the doctor of your future is you.
You had a very profound awakening on that day. And you've just mentioned then that your father was used to death because of the war. And, you know, we had a conversation that I'd like you to share with the audience about people of our generation whose fathers were in the war or the last world war. Obviously, there are wars going on everywhere in the world right now. But, you know, that world, that last world war and our generation that were born, there was very much an expectation. Men wanted sons. They wanted the firstborn to inherit. They wanted every, you know, they wanted a boy. So how has that affected women, do you think, of my generation?
Well, I mean, if you think about the world we live in is currently drifting away a little bit from the patriarchal society. We've been patriarchal for probably 6 to 10,000 years, but that's all. We haven't been patriarchal forever. What happened was that there were intertribal wars and hunting accidents, and people would die in those, and the tribes realized that actually men were more expendable, and therefore they were the men were separated out into feeders, and women were separated out into breeders. So you could, you know, if you lost a woman, you lost that 9 months of possibility of replacing the man that died. Awful thought, but there we are. But what it's meant in those, you know, 6 to 9,000 years of development is that we've got to a place where the, you know, if you look at the royal family, the patriarchy rules inheritance. And certainly when I was born, that women got the vote in Britain in 1928. You know, it's not that long ago. It's not even 100 years. And so there are people alive today who remember when women didn't have the vote. And so the idea of the next baby along, and you've got to remember also that, you know, millions of people died in the war, and a great many of them were men. But there was also a sort of sociological fact of that, you know, it's like my mother was a fire warden during the war. And she would have been a very brave woman, but all that was hidden when my father came. My father had been out in Burma and, you know, done all the things that he'd done. But my mother's story was never told in that situation. And that suppression would have revealed itself in, you know, men particularly coming out of the war and women coming out of the war, wanting the next baby along to be a boy. And therefore, if there was a girl, there might be disappointment in that process. And what's been shown now with sort of embryonic research is that the development of embryos and babies is incredibly early. I mean, at 11 days, the cell has divided a few times, but the cells have divided into three types of cell: embryo, placenta and umbilical cord, those three types. But at 11 days old, they can migrate if there's damage. If some of the cells in the embryo die off for some particular reason, they get, you know, hurt or something, cells from the umbilical cord can move across to become part of embryo cells. So it's like a cell in the body has a deterministic feeling already about what it wants to be. And therefore, if there's this sort of overtone, well, I hope we have a boy, and they know they're a girl, at, you know, however many weeks this gender shift takes place, that disappointment about who you are comes way before you were born, and to accompany you all through life, because your parents dreamed of having this boy and you came out as a girl. So that disappointment, and I have spoken to a lot of people who have experienced something of that sort. They may say, oh, it would have been better if you'd been a boy. I mean, I knew an Indian lady who was a twin, and there are two sides to it as well. People get told these stories. You know, they get told that they were told that they it would have been better if they'd been a boy. You know, that's a double whammy. The Indian lady, she was born, and they arranged a celebration for the birth of the child. Because it was a girl, they cancelled the operation, the celebration.
Wow.
But then mum found out she was still pregnant and going to have another baby tomorrow. And when she had the baby tomorrow, it was a boy. So they reinstated the celebration.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So the beauty of the constellation model is that there are things where you've effectively got all those people in the room with you. They may be represented by other people in a workshop setting, or they might be represented by bits of felt that I put on the floor that sort of stand in the place of those people. But what happens is that you can actually reconcile some of those things. So, for example, a daughter might say to the representative of her mum, even if it's a piece of felt, you know, she can say, dear mum, I'm not your dream son. I'm your beautiful daughter. And I'm very happy with the life that you gave me. And I'm going to make the very best of it. And all the rest I leave with you. And it kind of hands back the responsibility for that stupid attitude that doesn't belong back to where it belongs. And what's been shown with, you know, partly Bruce Lipton's work on epigenetics is that it isn't about DNA. DNA just is almost irrelevant. The DNA, I mean, I share 50% of my DNA with a banana. You know, it's utterly ridiculous to think that DNA holds all the clues. And it's not true. Basically, it's epigenetic. So, for example, the little cells on the corner of my thumb, they rub off after about a fortnight. That's the longest they'll ever last. So a new cell has to be created. Now, they go back to DNA and say, we need a new cell. Okay, and that cell could be anything. It could be a blood cell, hair cell, skin cell, blood cell, anything. They all come from exactly the same DNA, and they're prepared exactly the same. But the epigenetics says, actually, we need a corner of the thumb cell. We don't need a blood cell there. That would be stupid. We don't need a nail cell. We've already got a nail. We just need a thumb cell. And that's what happens. So these progressions, you see how our environment and our history is carried in that process, because as we develop, all these things come into fruition with it. So that that idea that, you know, I should have been a boy or I should have been a girl. I mean, it happens the other way around. Don't get me wrong. I mean, if you've had, four boys in a row, you might well want the fourth one to have been a girl, just for balance.
For me, I only ever wanted girls, and I was so depressed when I was pregnant, when I was first pregnant. I mean, mortifiedly depressed, because I hadn't intended on having children. But the moment I had that first scan and I found out I was having a little girl, I was on the floor weeping with joy. And I think this is partly because I'm the last of six children. And my father was desperate for sons. So, you know, there were three girls and a son, and then two more girls came along. And I found out only quite recently, you know, in the last kind of 5-6 years, and my brother died nearly 30 years ago now. But I only found out recently in a Facebook group for the town that I was kind of born near. Somebody said, oh, are you Philippa Leigh from Brightwell Comes Otwell? And I said, yeah, I am. And they said, as in David's sister. I went, yeah. And she said, I was with Dave the night you were born. And he had gone to the phone box and phoned your dad, who had said, oh, a little girl. And he put the phone down, just said, oh my God, not another bloody girl. And he barely spoke to me in my whole life. And then he went on to have three daughters. I've spoken to one of his daughters, and they carry a lot of trauma because they know their dad wanted a boy. And for me, it was even kind of worse because my mum didn't want me at all. I was a mistake. And so she tried to abort me. And when she couldn't do that, she tried to commit suicide. And when she failed at that, she then got put into a mental asylum where we both had electric shocks. So all of this trauma that we have is quite extraordinary, and we carry it. And so talk us through, Rafe. You talk there about little bits of felt, but we kind of preempted what really it is. So you have people come to you. They know they're holding family trauma. So explain the circle, explain how it works.
I would hesitate to say they know that they're holding family trauma. They think they've got all of it, but they know that they've heard somebody say, oh, you should go and get a family constellation, or you go see Rafe, or give him a ring and see what happens. And they come along, and then to be honest, they're not sure. What shows up is how the trauma has affected them. Not, we don't go into the trauma, we don't repeat the trauma, we don't, you know, set that up. But what they realize is that, oh my God, that's been affecting me my whole life. Wow. And they leave it behind and they walk away. And that's the beauty of it, yeah.
When you say leave it behind, what process do you use with a client for them to be able to leave it behind?
Well, there's a book I've been reading fairly recently called In Utero I, and it's a fairly scientifically stated book with constellations at its core. But what they call them is homeostatically idealized sentences, which means that what they're trying to do is to get balance in within you by using sentences. And the sentences, that the sort of things that I will say is what I just said a little earlier, which is, you know, dear mum, I'm not your dream son, I'm your beautiful daughter. Those sorts of constructs, which in a way say, this has got nothing to do with me, I leave it with you. And the representative of the mother, if you can see the picture behind me, that's that sort of peacock tail. The green dot at the bottom is you, and all the blue dots going over that way are men, and all the other way are women. So behind you, there's like 254 people. Now, what's happened since the Victorian age, and particularly with wars, is that people feel responsible for their parents. But actually, the truth is that the parents are responsible for you. Without your parents, you wouldn't exist. Without my parents, I wouldn't exist. So the responsibility for my very existence is down to my parents. And what happens is, if you hand back that responsibility to them, they have nowhere else to go but hand it back to their parents, and so on. And it seems to trickle down in that way. And what happens when you do that is that the only thing coming back the other way has got to be love, because they've given you life, and it, many times in the constellation model, you're saying things like, you know, dear mum, thank you for my life, I got enough to be me, and it's an acceptance of exactly who I am, all the good, all the bad, everything that happened to me has brought me to who I am. But there's stuff that I don't, you know, I mean, I have an analogy, you know, I go into a supermarket and I like biscuits. I'll buy some biscuits. I don't buy all the biscuits they have on offer. I just buy the ones I like, that suit me, that, you know, I'm not particularly keen on dark chocolate. So I don't buy dark digestives. I buy light ones. You know, the point is that we can do this with families too. That side of the family, that bit that, you know, your grandfather was an axe murderer, I'm not going to take that on. I don't want to be an axe murderer. You know, take on the bits that you want. And what it gives you the opportunity, because you've got the layout of the hidden dynamics within your family system. So in a workshop setting, I might have you, your parents, your grandparents, perhaps some great grandparents, something else. Maybe there's some historic overlord of all that, like Mother India or the Catholic Church or something that was...
That's a deep hole.
Well, it is, but you can see, you know, you see your reaction to it. It's because it's as though, I mean, people who've been born in, say, Ireland and with the Catholic faith behind them, what's happened is that it's as though they're, it's almost like a family member, that church. Or that influence, or Mother India, the caste system was so strong. It's like a family member, which you don't get so much in other. You know, in Muslim, the overtone on what's the difference between a man and a woman is so powerful. It can be as though it's a family member, that faith, but it just shows up as sort of something extra to what you think you're looking at, you know. You just think you were born as a child and you grew up and you become an adult and you've had children and that's that. But then you realise that, you know, there are some things that are uncomfortable to be still living with. So that's when you turn to things like the constellation model. And one of the beauties of it is that it's very fast, and each bit is done in a complete gestalt. So there's no need to go back to that particular piece of work. You might lead you to some other bits, but that bit of work has been done in one go.
I find that extraordinary. I mean, we have the same with EFT and Matrix re-imprint, and you park it. What I find different between Family Constellations and EFT is with EFT, I mean, Louise Hay always had this great saying, you have to see the dirt in order to clean the house. And that's why we tap on the negative, you know, even though I'm fat and ugly, I'm trying to love and accept myself. You know, and you then reframe that. But with Family Constellations, you're not doing that, are you? You're not looking at the dirt.
No, because you're not looking at the... The where you are, you're looking at where you've come from and what you've carried with you that isn't really anything to do with how you would wish to run your life now. You know, there are people who inherited, you know, attitudes and bigotry and, you know, all those sorts of things that come down the line because of the family you were in. Well, I mean, one of the things that shows up is that human beings require a kind of loyalty to exist. You know, they have to belong. It's really important. I mean, I often say this, that, you know, if you get a baby salmon, you know, you get a salmon egg and you pop it in a jam jar and it grows into a baby salmon and you put it in a tank and then you release it into the wild, it will try and find its birthplace. It knows everything without any intervention by anybody else. Whereas humans are different. They, you know, that your best role model for being a man is your father, and your best role model for your woman is your mother. So you grow up with these capacities within you to be like them. And as you're growing up, you're expected to behave, and you're shamed if you don't behave, and guilty if you misbehave. And you end up with these structures, these rules of engagement, which, you know, the rules need to change. You know, when you're a tiny baby, or you're 2, or you're 5, or you're 10, the rules need to change because what's needed for you is different. You know, but a lot of people come out of, you know, they're 26 and they realize that they're, you know, you listen to them, and you think, well, he's still 3. You know, those things happen. You know, we all experience that. You know, somebody throwing a tantrum in a shop. You know, they're 54. You know, it's these things happen, and it's because they haven't allowed the rules to change. And what this is doing is, it's not shaming their parents, not saying you got it wrong. What they're saying is, that was perfect for me when I was 2. It's not perfect for me now. I leave it with you. And it's those sorts of frameworks of moving your, and you know, the EFT, NLP, all those things that use language in some particular way and change your neurology. What happens with a constellation is that neurologically the layout of the system is exposed. So people see where they fit. So they, you know, there doesn't need to be any shame or guilt or, you know, examining the dirt particularly. They just say that dirt, I'll leave over there.
I love that. I have an amazing woman coming on later on in the year called Emma Jane Taylor, and she leads a campaign called Not My Shame for sexual abuse victims. And she stands proud wearing her T-shirt, and it just says, Not My Shame. Mm. Because, you know, I was not the adult. I was the child. This is your shame. I'm leaving this at your door. And, you know, it's not just sexual abuse that we need to leave it at the door. You know, I know there are periods in my life, especially when I was incredibly ill, where I was a shit mother and, you know, I couldn't cope. And my mum had periods of her life that she couldn't cope. But that is not our children's fault. That is our fault.
And there's a lot of, I mean, sexual abuse is definitely being talked about now in a much more useful way, but sometimes it's misguided in its understanding. I mean, I had a family of four daughters who were all sexually abused by their stepfather, and the one who had the most difficulty was because she hadn't been sexually abused. And she felt she was ugly, too ugly to be sexually abused by her stepfather. But she was still suffering from sexual abuse, even though there was no technical sexual abuse in her experience. And sometimes the projections are just too much, and it's not really actually what happens. And one of the difficulties with, you know, the law and stuff like that is that court cases are usually, they don't help, they don't work, they don't, you know, if you take somebody to court, you know, it may take months or years where you're, you know, waiting for verdicts or waiting for interviews, and there's been a push on, you know, victim blaming all the way through. And people are scared of that, and it's really resolving that you've got to this place with who you are, and it sometimes it's so refreshing to see somebody just step out of that role of victimhood and move into a place where they feel sad for the perpetrator almost, because it's like they were the weak one, not me. I was the strong one. I survived. You know, and it moves into a different place. So, you know, I mean, I see it. I'm very conscious that I've never been triggered by anything that somebody said in one of my workshops. Nothing has ever got to me, apart from one little thing, which was interesting.
What was that?
Well, it goes into EFT and Matrix as well, actually, because what was happening was sometimes I get people in foreign countries. I was speaking to somebody before Christmas in Romania, and I had somebody in Canada on Friday. And, you know, all these things happen. And if I'm asking them to say something to their mother or their child or something like that, I ask them to speak in their mother tongue if it's not English. I unfortunately only speak English, and therefore they have to speak to me in English. But if they're speaking to another partner or a person within the framework, they speak in their mother tongue. And what I found was that when somebody speaks Russian to somebody who's younger, it really broke me up. I was in tears.
And I thought, really?
What the hell's going on?
Why?
Well, this is what happened. It happened three times, and I thought, I've got to look into this. So I got a friend of mine who's a practitioner in EFT and Matrix and done a bit of constellation work as well. And what we looked at was that we went I'd fairly recently been over to Berlin to look at some, I wanted to find the grave of my seven times great grandfather who died in 1751 for some reason. There was a story that led to that. But what showed up was that his wife was Russian or maybe, I mean, they were all sort of Brandenburg. So it wasn't exactly Russia and it wasn't exactly Germany in those days. But she had to go back because she would have been unsafe to stay where she was. And she went back. And what it felt like in the piece of work we did was that he had told his son that she had died, but she hadn't died. And he used to stand by the trees in their garden and sing to his mum. And it felt like his mum did the same thing on her side of the border, you know, hundreds of miles apart or whatever. But it was that had reflected, and that Russian just clicked that. And
hit the nerve.
You know, those are the things that show up in this work. You know, you go back to something, and what shows up is an attitude or a feeling or words that just relate to that time. And it's not something I mean, the number of times people have, you know, I mean, I get people in the workshop who've never met each other before, and yet they stand in for as a representative of somebody's grandmother or something like that, and they'll say something, and the client who's just sitting out and watching and listening to what's going on, and she'll go, oh my God, that's exactly what she would have said. And it's like it's not role playing, there's no script, it's like you've offered a space to stand into that person's, I don't know what you call it, their field of energy.
Spirit, you know. But yes, it is very much an energy. You're working in the field, aren't you, really?
That's right.
Yes. You're out in the field. For anybody that hasn't seen any of my podcasts on the field, Ray, fill us in what the field is.
Well, In a workshop, you've got me, there's somebody who's a client, and then you've got a kind of a circle of chairs where people are sitting because it's convenient because they can listen and see and hear and stuff. But the space inside that circle is like a field of energy of the person who's doing the piece of work. And, you know, one of the most important things that I say to people is that the expert in the room is the client, not me. I'm not the expert in the room. They're the expert in their life. They know all the stuff. They may not know they know the stuff, but they know it. And what happens is that they'll sit there and tell some facts about their early life, probably. It's most likely that's the way it'll go. And then some names will come up, you know, my mom, my dad, my uncle Bert, you know, whatever it is. And I'll ask them to choose people to represent them. And they go and ask somebody to represent my mom. So that person can say no, I don't want to do that, that's fine. Or they'll say yes, in which case they stand up and the client or issue holder puts their hands on their shoulders and moves them to a place in that circle that feels right. As it's an odd feeling because they've probably never done anything quite like that before, but they all find something. And sometimes when they find it difficult to find somewhere, it's often them that finds it difficult. I don't know where I belong is their theme. And it's a theme they've been running all their life. I don't know where I belong. And therefore they get somebody to represent themselves and don't know quite where to put them. So at the end of that process, you've got three or four people standing up in this field, and the client sits down and watches and listens to what's going on. Now, when those four people are standing up, there are some things that you can observe immediately. For example, it's quite common for the representative of the client to not be seen by anybody. They're all looking in different directions and the person in the middle isn't seen. And you, as soon as you say, you know, Frieda isn't being seen, it, you know, the client sitting there goes, oh, God, that's exactly how it was. It's always been, never been seen. I'm not seen now. You know, and they recognize in that moment what they've done is allow the energy that they have for the people in their system to show up. They've allowed the energy to show up. And what happens is you get somebody to stand in that energy and they feel it. You know, and I mean, energy is like that. I mean, I know lots of people who, you know, they don't want to go into the shopping precinct because there are too many people, or they, you know, they feel all the, you know, the anger and the grief of the people walking by. They feel, and that's the energy.
That's absolutely normal, in the same way that, you know, if you go to a concert and you hear that piece of music that was kind of vibing in your heyday on the dance floor, and you just take on that vibe and you raise to that vibration. And, you know, same as if you walk into a room and there's just been an argument and you take on that vibe and you go, oh, God, I want to get out of here. You know, so everything is energy. And the more that we accept that, the more we can change what the energy has done to us. I want to move on to another technique you do now. And you once said to me that people come along to you for hypnotherapy, but that's not what they get. So talk a little bit about hypnotherapy and what they do get.
Yeah, well, the what hypnotherapy is to, we all have a conscious and a subconscious going on all the time. And most people will have experienced something like you're sitting in front of the television and, you know, your wife comes in or your husband comes in and says, what the hell are you watching? And you go, well, no idea. And how long have you been? 40 minutes. My God. You know, and you've been out of it for 40 minutes. And everybody regards that as just sort of semi-normal. That's they've been in their subconscious. And their conscious mind has been somewhere else. So it's those two things. Now, what happens with, you know, the most common request for hypnotherapy is about smoking, and the smoking thing is, you know, probably goes back a long time, and they want to stop. But is it the whole of them? Is it their subconscious? Is it their conscious? Is it they've been told to stop by their doctor or their wife or the partner or whatever? And it's unpicking that. So if they're genuinely, I want to stop smoking, I really have a need to stop smoking, then their subconscious and their conscious are probably in a bit of an argument. And the process of hypnotherapy is to bring those two places at the same time and have a dialogue in an etheric way, so that the talk of, you know, going down some steps or, you know, those sorts of things just brings you down to a level where you can, the conscious mind can hear the subconscious and agree. And at the end of that, you don't want to smoke anymore. You don't feel like it. It's not replacing it with, you know, chewing gum or whatever it is. It's just relieving the pressure. But an awful lot of people come for that, and they've just been told by somebody that they should give up, and they feel like they ought to, but they don't really want to. And they don't, that dialogue isn't going on in their subconscious. So when somebody in that frame comes to me and they want hypnotherapy to give up smoking, for example, what I may point them to is that it may be that they, for example, children who, you know, in my day, there was a thing of being seen and not heard. And, you know, those sorts of things are preferably not seen either. And in that frame, they may have realize that a smoke screen is a very good idea. And that, for example, if you're an adult and you're smoking, then the person you're sitting opposite may want to be a little bit further back in order to really, so they don't. So creating a boundary between you and them becomes important. Now, tapping into that, either with EFT or matrix or constellations, may show up what's going on and why they needed to smoke in the first place. Now, that has a different outcome in that they probably carry on smoking for a few days, but then they realise they just didn't yesterday. Hmm, that's strange. You know, I didn't fancy a cigarette. I didn't need one. Hmm, okay, fine. I'll live with that.
I had hypnotherapy to give up smoking when my girls were little.
Yeah.
And I trained as a classical dancer. And in the world of classical ballet, you are never enough. And so, you know, I was considered hugely fat and I was a stone lighter than I am now. And so I think just about everybody at ballet school smoked. And it was a terrible, you know, a habit that I took with me through my life. And I was just about to say terrible habit, because somebody said to me recently, oh, you know, how could you do such a terrible habit? And I'm going, I don't tell my body anything's terrible that I do. I tell my body to suck it up and it's absolutely brilliant and it can cope. But I had hypnotherapy and I came out, and I did it because we were going to America for my husband to work, and we were going for a month and you couldn't smoke in America. And I thought, okay, I've got to have some help. I'm going for hypnotherapy. And it was such an amazing feeling. And I came out of the room and I was just phoning everybody. I think I ran into the street screaming, I'm a non-smoker for life. I'm a non-smoker for life. And I was so excited that I was a non-smoker for life. And I felt amazing. And then the second week we're in America, we're at a friend of mine's wedding. So we'd arranged the trip around work and this wedding. And we get there and it's in a private place that they've hired and everybody's smoking. And I'm just like, oh, fuck it, I'll have a cigarette. And I was so angry with myself because I felt so ecstatic and so comfortable. But the minute I was around everybody else that was smoking, it went. How can that happen?
Well, I mean, your ecstasy wasn't about smoking or not smoking. You probably felt a bit of both, you know. I mean, the thing is about, loyalty, that you wanted to fit in. And fitting in is the primary reason why a lot of people become alcoholics. You know, it's fitting in with the crowd, joining in and not being seen to be separate. Well, we're living in a better time now, in that people are allowed to be a bit more individualistic, and those things have changed a bit. But the ecstasy originally was that you can see that what you were describing about smoking, there was a conflict between the subconscious and the conscious mind. So getting into hypnotherapy would have revealed that to each of them. And then they make a decision. You're either going to be a smoker and enjoy it, or you're going to stop smoking and enjoy it. And the dopamine factor and oxytocin and all the rest of it, they will applaud your action, whatever it is. You know, it doesn't... They don't care whether you're smoking or not smoking. They just want you to be happy. And in those hormones, just bring it on. So in that frame, the subconscious is saying, actually, I agree, we shouldn't smoke. And the conscious mind says, okay, we'll stop smoking then. And you come out of that ecstatic because all those hormones are, whistling around, the neurotransmitters are getting going and saying, woohoo! But then you get into a place where that's suddenly not right, in that it's not producing that euphoria of being a non-smoker, because in that framework of a party where everybody's smoking is it could be even seen to be dangerous, depending on how your early life went. It could be not being part of the crowd might be dangerous. It might be against your future intentions. So in that frame, you would smoke. You might have thought I used to smoke. I can have one cigarette. If I go to somebody's wedding, I will have one cigar. And it doesn't mean I go back into it. That's fine. I can do that.
That's unusual, because most people, if you have that one cigarette, then you go back into smoking. I I did an interview recently with the beautiful Paula Carnell, and we were talking about nicotine and it being addictive. And then we found out after we filmed the podcast that nicotine actually isn't addictive as a plant, which neither of us knew when we filmed it. So, you know, it's that feeling of relaxation and joy that is addictive. But because cigarettes have a lot of other completely toxic chemicals in, and nicotine, if you look at it in, you know, kind of Native American times, it was considered one of the most powerful plants in their ceremonies, you know, and they had api, and I've experienced api, and it is an extraordinary experience, and why Sir Walter Raleigh must have been, you know, over in the good old year of A and kind of going, oh my God, there's this amazing, amazing plant called tobacco, and brought it over to the, you know, back to the Queen of England. Yeah, it's a tricky one. I did ask a hypnotherapist after I started vaping very, very heavily after my spinal fusion, and I spent, you know, as I think everybody here knows now, 2 years of my life in bed addicted to opioids and alcohol. Couldn't get out. So my ex-husband bought me a vape and I became hugely addicted to that. And I phoned a hypnotherapist and asked if we could have a session so I could stop this. And she said to me, do you want to? Do you want to? Simple question. And I went, I don't know. I know I should. She said, you've got to want to. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, I've been starting to write a book about dopamine addiction and social media and Fortnite and all those sorts of things with kids, because the way some of these neurotransmitters work is that the hit comes at an unusual moment. For example, if you're a gambler, the dopamine hit is just before you find out whether you've won, not after you've won. So winning isn't the hit. The hit is thinking you might win. And therefore, when you've won, you've just got more money to spend on that hit. So you spend more on getting that hit. But the hit comes before you, the roulette wheel has stopped. It's the same with things like, you know, smoking or opiates or anything like that. Examining where the hit comes from, the anticipation of the high is more potent than the high. And the low that comes doesn't deter you from going towards the high. And it's those things that are the difficulty with those aspects. And it's the same with, you know, the kids' addiction to social media is the same sort of thing, in that they the anticipation that they're going to get, somebody's going to get likes on their Facebook page or whatever it is, the anticipation of that is more important than the actual likes they've got. And when they've got likes, you know, if they've got 100, they want 1,000. If they've got 1,000, they want 10,000. And it's just that, because it's the next bit that gives
it's the next hit, yeah.
So, and the hit is the dopamine is just a brain chemical produced in order to make you feel good. And you know, that's where it's at. There are four distinct hormones in those neurotransmitters that affect, you know, how we behave, and the addiction is about them. So it's irrelevant whether nicotine's addictive. It's the dopamine that you get from the idea of having a cigarette that is actually the addictive part of it. So getting the cigarette out of the packet and lighting it is, and you know, if you mentioned the Native American stuff about tobacco, and the thing is that the Native American used a lot of those things in ceremonies and rituals, and certainly in UK in 2024, the number of, you know, rituals and ceremonies that are performed is relatively few. But if you know, 10 years ago, if you walked past an office block, you would find, you know, five people standing outside tapping their cigarette three times and using their favorite lighter to light it, and the sacred tobacco inside their cigarette. You know, they would be feeling ritual and ceremony, and it would satisfy their soul. And it's the ritual and the ceremony that they're going for, actually, being with colleagues and friends. I mean, when I worked at the employment service in Sheffield for 3 years, rolling out computers into job centres, and the main boss of the he was a smoker, so I took up smoking in order to be sitting in the room with him, so that I could feed ideas to him, and then he would feed ideas back to me, and we would do what I suggested in the first place. A bit manipulative, but I took up smoking specifically for that, because it engaged with that group aspect. There's no way that in a smoking room there would be a hierarchy. There was no, you know, he was the boss, and the cleaner was in there, and I was in there, and everybody was just sort of chatting, and it was fine.
You're absolutely right. It takes out
everything,
doesn't it? You're just on a break having a cigarette.
That's right. So it levels the playing field, I needed to belong to that group in order to get what I wanted to do for rolling out the next phase of the process. I was involved with software, and Tony Blair was inventing New Deal for this, New Deal for that, and New Deal for the other all the time, and they were sort of posting on TV what we were doing and all that sort of thing, because he was very proud of it. And we were having to sort of catch up all the time. So they needed some brand new ideas. But because being the boss of the IT establishment, he was a bit reluctant. So getting in other words, if I'd gone to his office, knocked on the door, sat on the other side of his desk, and posed those ideas, he would have said, well, I'm not sure it's going to work, and all that sort of stuff. Whereas in the smoking room, I could say, you know what we ought to do? And, you know, we ought to sack the government and do this and do that. And do that. Those are the things you can say in that football crowd type of awareness.
Never has there been a more important time in history to sack our government. I say them right now.
Yes. Yeah. We need to get into the smoking room with Rishi Sunak.
Yeah, we won't go there. We won't go. That's another podcast. Well, we spoke earlier. We're coming towards the end of the podcast. We spoke earlier about emotional freedom technique, EFT. But there's something else that you do with you train in and coach. And that's, what's it called? Financial freedom technique.
Yeah, well.
Just tell us what that's about.
Yeah, we've struggled a little bit with the name of it, but what happened was during, about 10 years ago, I ran some money mindset workshops, which were pretty successful. But there was I was partnered with somebody who was doing sort of the counselling or the NLP part of it. And then during COVID, there was a trauma workshop online, webinar. And there was a woman that I met on that who lives in Derbyshire too. So I posted on the chat that let's meet for a coffee and have a chat. And we met online while COVID was going on. And I said I used to do these money mindset workshops. And she said, I've always thought about doing something like that. And what the thing is with the work that I do on sort of ancestral work with the constellations, you realize that some of the ways we think about money belong in the past. You know, my parents used to say, if you look after the pennies, the pounds will look after themselves. It's not true. You know, if you look after a gladioli, you don't get a palm tree, you get a gladioli. So, you know, I'm sorry, but if you look after pennies, you have pennies. It's tough, but that's the way it is. And
you're so right. You are so right. I love that, because my mum and dad used to say that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's common after the war. I mean, you know, difficult times, rationing, all that sort of stuff. You can get where they came from, but it's not where I came from. You know, actually, when I was growing up, We had plenty. We were all right. We were in a middle class family that was doing all right. My father worked hard. And, you know, all that sort of thing went on. But what Jenny and I realised was that there's a scope for moving people out of that mindset into a different mindset about their money mindset. In other words, they don't have to be poor forever. They don't have to be good enough forever. They can be exceptional. They can be something or other. So what we devised was this workshop model of using the constellation and sometimes a little bit of matrix in order to fathom out what was going on when they were a child in terms of money and how it looked and how it felt and what they've managed as a sort of strategy for living and being honourable to that that was laid down by their parents. How, you know, what did they do in order to do that? And then for some other work, usually NLP or sometimes matrix, in order to move them from that place into, you know, reframe some of the words that they have and to change that. We've had some phenomenal feedback, you know, people who've been stuck and feeling that they'll never get anything, and that 2 weeks after they've done the workshop, they've, you know, got a huge order because their mindset shifted and allowed that possibility to be available.
I think one of the reasons I've been, and I do consider myself to have been successful financially in my life. Obviously, at the moment, all I can do is keep remortgaging my house because I've started all of this, but I have a really beautiful house because I was successful. And I think it came back from a belief that I took when I was little. My parents were very poor. You know, we only had tomato sandwiches because my dad didn't grow cheese. We lived in kind of a very small cult wooden bungalow that was bloody freezing. There was no heating. You only allowed the bar fire on if there was ice on the inside of your window. And if my mum wanted to go and have a haircut, or she didn't buy clothes because she made her own, she made all of ours. But, you know, and she did her own hair and permed it and everything. But I remember they were going to a wedding and she went and asked my dad if he could possibly afford for her to have a haircut. And he's going, no, Monica, I can't, you know, sorry, we haven't got the money. She's going, really, I just don't want to cut my own hair to go to a wedding, and please. And I just, at that moment in time, just thought, I will never, ever ask a man for money. I will never be reliant on whether a man tells me that I can have a haircut. And I went from a very young age with a very determined mind that I would make my own money. And I got a divorce, so I gave most of my money away, but I'll make it again. I'm absolutely certain that I would never, ever ask. And, you know, that is a mindset, and we all have that, and we can absolutely all shift it.
Yeah, yeah. And it seemed to be there's been a difficulty in selling the concept and how you package that, because there's an awful lot of people who they don't believe that anything can happen in one go for a start, and they don't believe that they've got a problem. You know, they're just poor.
And that's life. That's where I was, you know.
That's right. And there's a lot of excuses of that, you know. Well, you know, what do you expect with all the, you know, the fuel going up and these multimillionaires getting tons of money for it? And, you know, you hear all those reactions, which are just excuses for not dealing with your stuff, actually.
Yeah, and, you know, we can deal with our own stuff. You know, it's time, as we said earlier, to deal with the governments of the world and the corruptions. You know, 1% of the money, you know, all the money is with 1% of the population. There is phenomenal greed at the top end. But now is a time that a great awakening is happening, and people are beginning to understand the powers that we have within us. We're all born with these powers. And do you agree, Rafe, that the great awakening is happening?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I totally agree that we all have the power to shift. And you know, my bit of the journey is just to help people see what they're carrying and where it belongs.
and where it belongs. Yeah, that's the important bit, where it belongs. Well, this has been just a fascinating conversation, Rafe. I've absolutely loved it. And before we go, please tell the audience where they can find you and, more importantly, your books. I know you've been updating a book this year over the last year. So fill us in where they can find you, all your work.
Okay. Well, I have a sort of hub website called just Rafe, R-A-F-E dot website. And you can find all the links in there. In the past year, I've updated a couple of my books. There's an original book that I wrote about family constellations. It's just called Family Constellations. And then I wrote a book. I mentioned the sort of sentences that we use, the homeostatically orientated sentences, which is a very highfalutin term for just sentences. But I wrote that book, and that's attracted quite a lot of people to come to me from all over the world. So it's, you know, this little book here.
And what's the title of that one? It's Rafe's Field.
Rafe's Field Guide to Constellation Sentences 2024.
But love that.
Yeah. So they're all available on Amazon. So I'm easy to find.
Brilliant. Well, we'll put everything in the show notes, Rafe. It has been, as I said, an absolute joy. And remember, lovely people, the doctor of your future is you. Thank you for being here. Thank you, Rafe.